It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. I spent some time in Kachemak Bay State Park this summer, and I was amazed at how the facilities built there over the years are going back to nature, including trails that are impassable, dock that has been in need of replacement can't be used. As Alaska faces budget shortfalls, the cost of maintaining our public land will be just another line in the budget to be cut, but we don't seem to be doing a great job with that. On today's show, we'll find out where our state park fees are going, how much money is needed, and options we can devise for volunteerism or alternative ways to keep our parks usable. I think we all know that the oil price is down, the state government is massively in deficit, and there's a lot of things that are going to be changing. But for those of us who love outdoor recreation and love our state parks, that's a little bit of a scary prospect because I think some of us feel like we're already not spending enough money as it is. So I've got two perfect guests to discuss this today. And I put some time into thinking about this because I knew that our current director of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, or the State Parks Director, Ben Ellis, he is working for the state government. So he probably can only go so far what he can say, although I'm sure he'll be as candid as possible. I've also got Jim Stratton, who's a former director of State Parks, and whose voice will be well known to Anchorage Public Radio listeners as the host of the Arctic Cactus Hour. So thanks for being with us, Ben.
Thank you.
And Jim.
Yeah, you bet.
So I started with this note about Kachemak Bay State Park. Our listeners know that I spend a ton of time in Kachemak Bay every year, and as I recall, some of these facilities were built sort of with oil spill money, and I don't know, maybe built beyond what we were able to maintain. But some of the stuff has sort of like gone, you know, not been maintained. And so I guess to begin with, what is the we're going to talk a lot about what the sort of the maintenance budgets are and everything and get into the big picture. But Ben, I just thought I'd give you a chance to talk about this because I already dinged you on it right off the top.
Not a problem, Charles. you're right. You know, I think everybody pretty much knows Alaska has 3.3 million acres for state parks. It's the largest land section of state parks in the nation. It is very diversified. And starting 40-some-odd years ago, we have acquired land and developed facilities. Unfortunately, during that time, we've accrued about $60 million of deferred maintenance that needs to be addressed. And you've hit two of them that you were talking about down in Kachemak Bay. It takes about $3 million a year that goes toward deferred maintenance or toward maintenance and capital improvement projects to keep us even.
Wow. So
several years ago, we got a few bumps, about 4 years ago, and then again about 5 years ago, a little bit more than $3 million, and we were able to pull that deferred maintenance level down. As most people know, in this last budget cycle, there were virtually no CIPs. Those that had a federal match went forward, but as far as deferred maintenance, say, in parks, there was none. So, again, our deferred maintenance is starting to creep back up, and we have to take it a case-by-case basis. We look at the use of the area, revenue that's brought in from the area, obviously safety for the public in the area, and those that we can't address it immediately. We need to close until we can address them so we can ensure safe recreation for the public.
Right. So that dock in Halibut Cove Lagoon, which is essentially dismantled because I guess there was corrosion or something.
There was corrosion on at least one of the pilings. And so we have put forward deferred maintenance money that we had received about 2 years ago toward that. So it should be improved and open next summer.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. So, Jim Stratton, you were there, I guess, in the Tony Knowles years. It didn't feel like there was probably extra money then in those days either.
There was no extra money in those years. I mean, budgets were really, really tight. You know, we went through the exercise every year of, you know, cutting the operation budget, you know, cutting the number of park rangers, the amount of trail crews. It was kind of a reoccurring theme for the whole eight budget cycles that I worked through. But we were fortunate to have some oil spill money that was left over from one of the criminal settlements. And we were invested that in, you know, Kachemak Bay State Park and other parks that were in the spill region. And we tried to build those really bomb-proof, knowing that there probably wouldn't be maintenance money down the road. So when people look at that dock in Kachemak Bay and they go, my heavens, that thing is huge. Well, it was strategically built, you know, basically to last. It's lasted almost 20 years, you know, before they've had to do any maintenance on it. And that was one of our strategies was, okay, the money that we have that's, you know, special money, like from the Exxon Valdez, what can we build that's really going to last? Because we knew we didn't have a whole lot of maintenance money.
Right. So why, I mean, just to start philosophically, why is there this reluctance to spend money on maintenance, which is just a minuscule pittance of the state budget, when we know that a huge part of our economy is based on tourists who are coming to Alaska and heavily using these facilities? I mean, I'll start with you, Jim.
I mean, it's the $64,000 question. You know, you look at the amount of money that comes out of the state budget to fund, you know, the park system, you know, the boat launch ramps, the campgrounds, and it's less than 1/1000th of 1% of the state budget. I mean, it's a rounding error. It's ridiculous, but it's a perplexing question because it's something that I've had to struggle with when I was director. Now Ben struggles with it. It's like, why do we have to make the case that just a couple million dollars investment in a state park system that Alaskans use? You know, it's interesting. If you have friends that come up from the lower 48 or family, you take them to the national parks. But Alaskans recreate in the state parks.
And well, you take them to Glen Alps, too, right?
And you take them to Glen Alps, too, right? But, you know, Alaskans are the predominant users of the state park system. And you try and, you know, educate legislators about, you know, this is not, you know, something that we're doing exclusively for visitors from outside. We're doing this for your constituents. You know, people in your districts use these parks and you need to, you know, pay attention to them. And they're also huge drivers of local economies. I mean, these little parks that, you know, like Anchor Point, for example, you know, you've got Anchor River State Recreation Area right next to that town lives off that state recreation area.
Right.
And it's just, I don't have an answer because I don't understand it because it makes so much sense to the three of us in here. It's like, well, a little bit of investment certainly goes a long ways in keeping those parks functional and keeping people going to them.
Do you feel like we as outdoor folks are maybe concentrating too much on our gear and our next hiking trip and not enough on contacting legislators and telling them, like, hey, this matters to us. We're not going to vote for you next time. I'll give that one to you, Jim. I mean, because I don't feel like there's a real lobby for this.
No, it was a problem that I had. And of course, I came from an activist background when I, you know, came into being park director. So, you know, I knew how to organize folks. And there were state park advisory boards all over the state. And we worked really closely with those folks because they're all volunteers and really helped them understand what the budget situation was so that they could work on their local legislators. But, you know, organizing organizers is a full-time job, and being the park director, you got a lot of stuff on your plate and you just didn't have the time to really put in to really, you know, do the lobbying, if you will, you know, to get those people to step up.
Is there a little bit of a limitation on you as a... I mean, you can only do so much, I think, as a public employee, right?
Oh, right. I mean, all I could do was...
You can't go out and say, vote against Legislator X. He didn't support the parks.
No.
Not if you want your job.
Yeah.
You know, it's all in how you present the information. And so, you know, I got to say, we got pretty creative in presenting the information to these advisory boards so they would, you know, kind of go, oh, we get it. You know, should we connect, you know, contact our legislator and tell them about this? Well, that would be a good idea.
Right.
You know, and there's ways you can do it, but it takes a lot of time. And you're right, there is no state park lobby. Like there's, you know, the national parks have the National Parks Conservation Association out lobbying for their budget and all that. And we tried to organize something like that in the 90s, but it just didn't take off.
Yeah. So, Ben, I want to put some scale around sort of the costs and what's required sort of in... And maybe we can start with trail maintenance because that's something that's very easy to understand. Just some guys with axes and chainsaws getting out and clearing out the trails and smoothing them out, making sure they're usable. We did a show a couple of years ago now on trails, day hikes from Anchorage. And so we had a trail guy from the state park and a trail guy from the National Forest. And I was astonished to hear that the National Forest trail maintenance budget was like 10 times what your budget was. And when I heard how small the budget was for maintaining the trails in Chugach State Park, I just felt like, holy mackerel, how could they even do it, right? So give me a sense of like how much it actually costs to maintain
Sure.
your trails.
Sure. Charles, let me back up because it's a good segue. You were talking about advocacy, mm-hmm. and definitely we work with our advisory groups throughout the state on the areas and push forward. One of the things that I've seen when I tried to resurrect what Jim had done back in the 90s is for a statewide foundation, mm-hmm. and that's really kind of where many states have gone,
yeah.
is that I found that, and I'm not being critical, this is just what a fact is, that the advisory boards are so parochial. They're passionate about Chugach State Park, or right. they're passionate about Denali State Park, or they're passionate about Kachemak Bay State Park, or mm-hmm. Haines, or wherever it might right. be, that many times they have a very difficult time sort of getting out of their own way
yeah.
to support a park system approach.
Mm-hmm.
And in the states that have very active state park foundations, they have been able to address some of these funding shortfalls or maybe enhancements that so far in the state of Alaska, we haven't. Second point on
And we can get into that because we have a model for that here in Anchorage with the Anchorage Park Foundation.
Exactly.
Let's save some of that discussion, okay. but I want to get the listeners just an idea of how much money we're talking about because I think that some of these numbers are going to be smaller than people think.
Right. Well, yeah. well, actually, the second part dealt with advocacy too, and that is that 99.9% of our money that goes to work on trails, either new trails or cleaning up trails, is federal money. It comes from, in this case, it's called MAP 21. It's a federal highway plan. And so the state of Alaska receives about $1.6 million a year. And then the state of Alaska has decided, and it's been done this way maybe forever. It probably was done this way when Jim was the director. That is split in half. And half of that goes out to trail organizations that they can apply for grants through that system. There is a body of people that score trail projects, and the grants are awarded. The other half goes to Alaska State Parks trail programs. So we get about $700,000, $750,000 a year to apply to over 900 miles of maintained trails
wow.
in the state. So I think you can see that there's a lot more need than what the funding is. 2 years ago, it changed slightly, and the because of some other funding, $200,000 was going to need to be injected in from the UGF, from Unrestricted General Fund, in to be able to keep the program viable. And trail organizations and trail advocates came out of the woodwork in supporting that through their legislature and letters and going to actually Juneau to talk. And that $200 was put into the budget to be able to leverage the $1.6 million. Without the $200,000, we wouldn't be getting the $1.6
million.
Okay, wow. So I got to give a kudos to the trail groups.
So people did get involved.
They did get involved when they heard the, you know, the cry. Mm-hmm. And so that's very heartening. And that
right.
can happen, I think, in other areas dealing with whether it's trails or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's very, like I said, 900 miles of maintained trail throughout the state. And we're not even really talking about like snow machine trails, which are abysmal as far as the number we have and the size of the state we have
yeah.
and the growing numbers of snow machiners that we have. There's virtually no funding to help create new trails and very, very little funding to maintain what we have. During the time that Jim was a director, snow machine registration fee came online, and Jim set up a snow track program that helps maintain trails. We only receive about $220,000 a year to maintain groomed snow machine trails, and that's probably about a third or less than the money that we really need to do to provide that recreational mm-hmm. opportunity.
So in terms of what does it cost to send a trail crew out to get some trails in shape? I don't know how long, what the best way to quantify this is in terms of like maybe how much money you spend on a particular park or a particular trail. We had one of your employees from Independence Mine State Historical Park on a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about, well, Hatcher Pass, we didn't actually have any trail maintenance this summer. And it seems to me, I mean, I know a little bit about trails. If you go a year without maintaining a trail in Alaska, you're in rough shape. You go 2 years, your trail's starting to disappear. So I'm just wanting to get a sense of, like, what does it cost to maintain trails?
I mean, Charles, I don't know if I can give you a figure that says it's this amount of mile. I don't know if Jim may have that in the back of his head. What I do know that we do receive, like I said, $750,000 a year to go toward trail maintenance, but that is for the entire state.
Right.
And normally that will be about one, in some cases, two trail projects for a unit. So Chugach may have one or two. Matsu and the Matsu area may have one or two. Northern may have one or two. But it's not much, because the demand is, instead of one or two, is somewhere between 5 and 10 as far as the need is concerned. So one is the amount of money. The two is the amount of, even with volunteers, and God bless the volunteers, we couldn't operate Alaska State Parks without volunteers. But as far as being on a trail crew is concerned, there still needs to be someone that's qualified to lead that run that trail crew, unless they've gone through the safety procedures for how to run a chainsaw, etc. Then they're not able to do those kinds of things. So we try to maximize as we can for those volunteers that would be sort of unskilled but have a great passion to be able to help do cleaning of brushing that's been cut or whatever it might be. But the need far outweighs the amount of money that we have.
Right.
So, Ben, do we still have the Alaska Conservation Corps?
Yes, we still have the ACC group, and that is set by statute, and they're basically young kids in their late teens and early 20s, and they come out and they help not only on trails, but they help do maintenance in other areas, but yeah, they're a great source of some young energy. Yeah.
Right, and it's like summer jobs, and so so it's not a full time park employee. So you don't have all of the retirement and the everything else.
Right.
It's a 3 or 4 month position, and I know we really relied on ACCs when I was there, and I'm glad to hear that the program is still going. And that's a place to find young people who have strong backs and are looking for a summer job. If we could figure out a way to get more money into there.
Right. And it also leads into, we have a number of employees today that started out as an ACC. In fact, I've got some superintendents that started out as that. So it's a great introduction into outdoor recreation management.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking today about funding for our state parks and keeping our state parks maintained and usable. And Ben Ellis, who's the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, is with me in the studio, and also Jim Stratton, a former director from years ago. Let's get a little bit of a status report on some. I understand there are some state parks down in Southeast that were actually closed, down in Ketchikan.
Let me correct something very quickly. They're not closed. They have been placed in passive management, and I can tell you the difference between
those
two.
And these were sort of those clan houses and those spots in Ketchikan, right? Where
It was Sitka and Valdez. What happened going into last legislative session? The division was required to reduce our operating budget by $500,000, $500,000. So we went through an assessment, and I'm sure it's an assessment that my colleague here and great friend Jim did when he was director, and that looking at the location, is it contiguous, is it next to another state park, or is it separate? What's the revenue? What's the cost of it to operate? Are there entities near it, the city, the borough, nonprofits that might be able to pick up, federal government, that might be able to pick up the operations if we, and I will use the word mothball rather than close.
Okay.
People are still in it, and we looked at that, we made that analysis, and there were two areas. There was a Sitka, and there was Valdez that we felt like it met those the criteria.
So and which one was it in Valdez? Was it the Glacier?
Well, it was the Valdez unit.
Okay, the whole thing.
Right. We had a Ranger base there.
I got you.
We had an ACCer that helped him and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it was the that unit dealt with public use cabins. It dealt with the Worthington Glacier. Uh-huh. It dealt with Blueberry
beautiful
Lake
campground. I love campground. That
campground. Yeah. Some of those areas, let's say take Valdez for an example, has worked out fairly well in that we were able to make the savings from that area of a staff reduction. But the campground, for an example, is concessioned out. So the public can still use the campgrounds. They didn't lose recreational opportunity. On public use cabins, we continue to rent those out. Most of the time, we will hear comments from the public about the public use cabin as far as maintenance that needs to be occurring a lot more than we might have a staff person because they're there every weekend or every day.
Yeah.
So we still bring in people to deal with the maintenance of the cabin. So we didn't lose the cabin revenue. The area that we did have a challenge was with Worthington Glacier and keeping the restrooms open. But we were able to get a contractor to come in and do those. So the good thing about the Valdez experience is that we were able to continue to provide the recreational opportunities at a reduced price, reduced cost to the state. Uh-huh. Same thing is happening in the Sitka area. And the National Park Service stepped up and Castle Hill and Old Sitka are taking over and helping provide the interpretation in those areas.
I bet the Park Service has a budget that's orders of magnitude larger, right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, when you start talking about what our federal compadres do,
and
Jim raised a bunch of money for him, so he can talk about that, but maybe we need to get him to raise a bunch of money for Alaska State Parks.
Yeah. Jim, you went through some of these same things in terms of mothballing and closing parks back in your day.
Fortunately, I staved off budget reductions 7 out of the 8 budgets that I was in. And so I only had to do it the last year that I was there. And I went through the same analysis that Ben did. You know, how much do I need to save? You know, where could I find those savings in a way that, you know, didn't impact lots of recreation, didn't reduce the income in? And I closed a bunch of parks in the Mat-Su, which greatly upset the Mat-Su delegation out there.
They thought it was revenge.
Well, actually, it wasn't. I mean, it really was a thoughtful process that we went through to figure out, you know, where can we save the money with the least amount of impact? And also the same thing that Ben talked about in the back of your mind is, are there local government entities or other agencies that would step up? And part of, you know, two of the units that we closed were at Big Lake. Well, the Big Lake Chamber of Commerce stepped up the next day and said, well, we're not going to, you know, these have got to stay open. We'll take care of those. Mm-hmm. And so we went through that and did close some areas. But the thing that you lose when you go through this, you know, this staff reduction is you don't have a park ranger there anymore. And a state park ranger is the best ambassador that the state of Alaska has for its citizens. Everybody likes park rangers. Park rangers not only just, you know, collect the fees and keep the bathrooms clean, but they answer questions. They provide law enforcement. They're an educational component. They help people out. They, you know, they make people welcome in these sites. I mean, there's a whole component.
It's about the most friendly, positive interaction with government you ever had.
Exactly. Yeah. And you lose that when you have to do these staff reductions and, you know, get a contractor to clean the bathrooms and, you know, and somebody else, you know, another concessionaire, you know, to run the campground. You know, the whole idea of concessioning out park units, I mean, I really resisted that because the motivation for someone as a concessionaire is to make money. Mm-hmm. The motivation of a park ranger taking care of a campground is to have a great recreational experience for the families that are there. Two very different motivations. And that's what you lose when you start, like, laying off park rangers and ACC workers and hoping that some local government entity or local another agency is going to step up and, you know, take over what is essentially a fundamental state responsibility. I mean, I think parks are as important to the people of Alaska, you know, as education and DOT and the troopers. I mean, it's a fundamental something that government should provide.
Ask somebody, why do you live in Alaska? And like 9 out of 10 right. will say because of the outdoors, right?
Right.
And that's what this is all about. Yeah. So I'm interested, Jim, when you look at those concessioned out campgrounds or campgrounds that are mothballed, the feeling at the time is often like, well, there it goes. You know, that's never coming back. You know, did when the money got better, did you see those things being picked up again and reopened and improved? Or do we always sort of look at, oh, let's build a new campground over here, and we never go back and get the old ones that were closed?
No, I think that when the money came back, I mean, I closed those campgrounds, you know, literally on my way out the door. And so, you know, they were opened up. I don't know if it was the next year or the year after that. But, you know, the money came back in, and, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities to build a bunch of new stuff, you know, with Alaska State Parks. It's, you know, it's land driven, and the places that the state parks have to provide recreation, those facilities are there. So I don't think there was a lot of emphasis placed on building new stuff. There was some emphasis, you know, placed on rebuilding. You know, we were able to do that with Exxon Valdez money. We rebuilt a number of campgrounds, like down on the Kenai River, that were, you know, kind of the condition that some that's Ben's dealing with now. Well, these are, you know, situations 15, 18, 20 years ago, the same thing, very run down, you know, the outhouse doors were broken, and we were able to take some Exxon Valdez money and go in and rebuild an existing facility. But as far as building new stuff, I think State Parks is pretty, pretty skookum yeah. on not doing that.
Charles, let me point out, because this is a great success story in dealing with the public and support from the grassroots level, and that was an area in the Fairbanks, north of Fairbanks, called Oldness Pond, and an area that for 10 years had been in passive management. And for the 10 years, there was no law enforcement from parks there, very little from troopers. Unfortunately, I mean, there was so much nefarious activity going on. There was stabbings, there was a murder,
oh my gosh.
There was drug dealing, there was burning of cars, there was, I mean, it went from a family-friendly area to one that nobody wanted to go to.
Uh-huh.
And the people in the Fairbanks area rallied around and was able to talk to their local legislators, and this was 3 to 4 years ago, and was able to, at that particular time, get it in the budget to provide not only staffing to be able to address it, but $500,000 going toward deferred maintenance that had not been done in 10 years. Again, that was the local people that love that park wanted to turn it around. So those things do come out of passive management, but it's very, very difficult.
Yeah. Boy, so much to talk about on this topic. In the second half, I want to talk about what the public can do. How do our $5 contributions when we go to that, or our season passes get used? You know, how does that money really come back? And I also want to talk about the strategy in terms of, if you put a lot of money into making it really last, does that mean you have to take away from other areas? Got a $60 million deferred maintenance? That's incredible. So we're going to continue with this topic as on the second half of Outdoor Explore. We're going to take a quick break and head to the trail, where APRN intern Sarah Bernard joined a group of young adults, 17 to 20-year-olds, two summers ago in the Chugach. The kids were put to work clearing trees, building bridges, and cutting trail. They spent a whole month at the Spencer Glacier Whistle Stop working on a new trail project. Here's APRN's Sarah Bernard.
Every morning at about 6:30, seven students and four crew leaders scramble out of their tents to make breakfast and hit the trail. The one they're building, that is. It's not easy work by any means, but 18-year-old Shauna Strain says it's been an amazing summer.
I want my career to be something like this. I know I can do trail building all my life, because like when I'm 80, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to cut down trees anymore. But I would totally love to like be a park ranger or something outdoors, someone that teaches others about nature and how to like appreciate it more and just preserve it, because it's depleting, so it's like, I want to save it.
Five different agencies want to help her and other young people do just that. The Chugach National Forest, the Student Conservation Association, and others all applied for a federal cost-share grant to help put students to work in Anchorage parks, on BLM lands, and in the Chugach. Trail crew leader Lauren Sinnott says part of the attractiveness of this program is the fact that these students are all from Anchorage or nearby.
What's really exciting about this program is that it is all locally recruited, so it's a great opportunity to work with a population that is connected to the land and the environment in a more personal way.
And since most of this crew are alumni from an Anchorage-based program called Youth Employment in Parks, the idea here is not just to drop kids off in the woods for a few weeks. It's also to help them think about what it would mean to get involved with land management in the long term.
It's really a next step program. We have students that we want to be able to work for Chugach in the future or to work at the BLM to become a park ranger in their own backyard, helping leaders become leaders, mentoring mentors.
Which Shauna Strain says is exactly what she'd like to do.
I think it's very important for youth and young adults and even kids to get out here and do this kind of stuff, because like it shows them that you don't have to always be in the office doing things that you don't like to do, because I personally hate being inside.
At Spencer Glacier, students are building the first mile and a half of what will eventually be a 17-mile trail connecting the Spencer Whistle Stop to the Grandview Whistle Stop. David Isles, public services staff officer on the Glacier Ranger District, says they definitely started from scratch.
It was raw ground when they first got here, covered in alder, vegetation, dense ground to get through. And they had to do all the chainsaw work, brush clearing, the tread work, so doing the earth moving and scratching line, putting in a brand new trail.
And that was a new experience for Shauna Strain.
I could have never imagined that we're going to make a trail out of straight forest. I walk on a trail like almost every day and I didn't know what it takes. Oh, a trail, it's probably just appeared out of nowhere. But like since you actually build a trail, it's like, oh my gosh, people will have no idea like how much hard work it takes to build this trail. So I'll never look at trails the same way ever again.
Diamond High School student Noah Otto says the experience has been really worthwhile. And working outside for Otto is one of the best parts.
You look up and it's blue, you look down and it's green, and that's all you need. You know, it's hard work. You feel tired, you feel accomplished, but you can really see what you've done. I mean, in office you probably can, but I mean, I'd be more impressed with a mile of trail than a stack of papers.
Shauna Strain agrees. Just being outdoors is enough.
Personally, this is where I get my sanity back. Like, get away from all the temptations of the city, come outdoors and see what the world is really all about, I think. It's like something I'm always going to remember, and I think it's going to be like one of my favorite memories, just to say that I actually did this.
And it could be the first of many memories that Strain and her peers will make working outdoors. From Spencer Glacier, I'm Sarah Bernard.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. Find Outdoor Explorer anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. We're also available online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is our Alaska State Parks, the funding, the deferred maintenance, and sort of the need for love that our parks have in a time of greatly diminished state revenue, and figuring out what's the future. In the second half, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit more about some solutions and strategies for how we as people who love the outdoors can help, because can't just give up on this, and it can quickly get very discouraged on this topic. I have two guests in the studio. Jim Stratton is a former director of state parks, and Ben Ellis is the current director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. I promised a discussion about our user fees. We have pretty much a $5 fee that we pay to the Iron Ranger when we're parking, or we can buy an annual pass, which is a good deal, boat ramp fees, and then, of course, fees for use of the public use cabins. And I remember in the past, and Jim, this might have been back when you were having your budget problems, as a reporter looking at this and finding out, well, golly, these fees are just going into the general fund and not even all coming back to the park. So I guess question number one is, how much are we already paying in user fees compared to how much is being spent on the parks? Ben?
Well, Charles, I can say that The route of a fee is a little winding, but it does come back to parks.
Okay.
Because the state has no dedicated funds, cannot allow dedicated funds fees that come in do go into the general fund. There's no doubt about it. But then in the budget process, there is a limit or amount that can come back to, let's say, state parks. And that is commensurate with the amount of fees that come in. So it comes into the general fund, and I don't care whether it's a parking pass, a boat launch fee, a commercial use fee, that goes into the general fund bucket, and then we get it sent back to us for the amount that came into it. And all then right. we can apply it to the operation of the system.
And how much of your budget is covered by that?
Good question. We went about 10 years without any fee increases. And there was a number of reasons for that. But 3 years ago, the legislature did a very thorough evaluation and had several hearings in Juneau on Alaska State Park fees and was very encouraging to us to raise our fees. And at that time, we were bringing in about 32% of our operating budget through fees. This past year, as probably some listeners remember, fees in all the areas, with the exception of the $5 parking fee that you referred to in the Iron Ranger, was increased. We're projecting that we'll bring in about 42%, between 42 and 44% of our operating budget this year, with the possibility of getting pretty close in 2017 of getting about 50%. The reason that we didn't increase the $5 parking fee was that we really didn't want to price anybody out of the opportunity to go to a park. So if they're only going once or twice or three times,
right.
You know, $5, and for some people that may be a lot of money too. So we didn't want to price them out.
Or a tourist who just pulls off the road, wants to look at the view, and right. says, oh, $5, I'm not paying that.
Right. Yeah. But for an active park user mm-hmm. that gets a park pass and is in parks throughout the summer, the increase there we felt was justified. And same thing in public use cabins and boat launches and so forth, camping fees.
So 40%. Of course, you have a lot of costs that are not necessarily like directly park maintenance. I mean, your salary, you know, you're not out there cutting brush, I expect. Do you feel like those fees cover sort of like the wear and tear that we're putting on these parks in terms of the maintenance cost, or no?
Not even close.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the paradigm has been in the past to be able to provide state funding. And Jim's philosophy was very, very well embraced for a number of years, that this was an obligation of the state to be able to provide this recreational opportunity, whether it was in the operating cost or the capital improvements cost. The pendulum has swung to more that of a user pay to play kind of philosophy. It's not unlike a lot of other states. There are a number of states that their operating budget is either somewhere between 85 and 100% funded by the fees that they bring in. Almost every state that I know of, the legislature feels that capital projects is still a state responsibility. Mm-hmm. But the ability to provide the campgrounds and the trails and the personnel out there is being shifted more and more throughout the United States onto the user.
Yeah. Jim, how do you feel about user fees? I you know, there was a long time when the national parks charged no fees, and then they called it an experiment because philosophically, it was part of the national park culture that this is belongs to the people, they shouldn't have to pay. Well, now those fees are pretty substantial, really. I mean, they've gotten up, you know, above $20 for some of them. What are your feelings about fees and this, sort of this user, you know, cost-cause or cost-payer concept. Does that work for you for parks?
Yeah, I mean, it does. I think the thing to remember about national parks in Alaska is the Alaska Lands Act said that you can't charge fees. So the national parks in Alaska continue to be free, you know, other than like going in on the Denali Road.
Well, I mean, they say it's free, but if you buy a bus ticket, they automatically add it onto your...
Right. Well, that's just it. The Denali Road is the exception because it was there before the Lands Act passed. But, you know, all of the other, like it's free to go to the Wrangells, Gates of the Arctic, you know, Kenai Fjords is free to go to Exit Glacier.
Right.
And that's legislated. But the
it's not free in the lower 48.
In the lower 48.
The large parks have large security. They have large fees.
And it's the same. I mean, they're running into the same problem as we've run into at Alaska State Parks, is that, you know, as budgets, you know, shrink, everybody's looking for how can I keep my program going? Well, fees are the obvious choice. And you add fees and you increase fees. So you charge for different things that maybe you didn't charge for 10 years ago, and then the prices go up. And I think a fee is a reasonable thing to charge as long as it doesn't get too much. And one thing that I discovered when I was park director is that when you had free campgrounds, for example, people didn't take care of them. Mm-hmm. And so you actually exacerbate your maintenance problem, because if it's free, then people would go in and they wouldn't respect it. And then you'd have much bigger problems, you know, messes to clean up and outhouses get blown up. And if you charge a fee, a certain segment of society refuses to pay and they'll go trash someplace else, right, and not trash the parks. And so, and that's a part of, you know, the whole fee charging thing that most people probably don't think about, but as a park manager, you know, you're constantly thinking about, okay, how can I reduce the maintenance? How can I reduce the vandalism? And one way is to charge fees. You know, the devil is in the details of like, how much is too much? And when do you start pricing people out? And as, you know, Ben talked about keeping the parking fee at $5 as a way not to start pricing people out of you know, going for a hike up in Chugach State Park.
It looks like another strategy that you've been pursuing to deal with this maintenance problem is that when you do your capital projects, and Jim, you touched on this a little bit, just build stuff really, really well. And I've noticed the new latrines at the state parks are bombproof. I mean, they're just look like you can literally bombproof. I mean, they're just very, very well built. And the South Fork improvements on Eagle River, you know, gosh, there's huge rocks, there's all this gravel. And you look at it and you think, wow, it must have cost a fortune to build this 1 mile of trail. You know, what did they give up for do this 1 mile of trail? But then presumably that mile of trail is going to last a long time. Is that part of what you're doing, Ben?
Charles, it's a trade-off. There's no doubt about it. But the type of the concrete toilets that you're referring to, the company CXC makes them, they are virtually bomb-proof. I mean, the amount of maintenance over the last, say, 10 years, as we've switched over in the last 8 years, on those are just has dropped the deferred maintenance on those way down. Mm-hmm. Same thing on trails, same thing on parking lots. The addition to the satellite parking lot at Glen Alps, for an example, it was expensive, $750,000, I believe. But again, it's providing people with safe place to park, not on the side of the road there, and it's bringing in revenue at the same time. So it definitely is a trade-off of how well you try to do things, and we don't want to do them in a Cadillac way, mm-hmm, but we want to do them in a sustainable way.
I was avoiding that word, but it costs more to build stuff that way. Let's talk about some of the things that the public can do to get involved. You brought up the point that you can't just have folks going out and doing their own trail maintenance because there's safety issues involved. But, you know, I think a lot of people would be willing to do that kind of work if they had leadership. And how do we make that kind of thing happen where we have more? I mean, I bet some of our listeners right now would say, wow, sure, I'd be happy to go out and spend a day doing that. That actually sounds kind of fun. How do we make more of that happen?
Well, here in Anchorage, they contact Tom Harrison, the superintendent for Chugach State Park. And actually, Tom gets a number of those types of contacts every year. And as far as I know, we've never not been able to find something for someone to do. They wanted to help, whether it was working on a trail crew, latrine duty,
volunteer. I'm sure you get a lot of volunteers for that.
Actually, we actually have.
Wow.
And or
that person really deserves some gratitude.
That's right. Or providing the interpretive presentations at Glen Alps. Hmm. A couple of years ago, there were a number of programs on Thursday night, I believe it was, dealing with activities and in the park, wild animals in the park, so forth. Uh-huh. And that was all created by volunteers.
So the Eagle River Nature Center is maybe a good model where a nonprofit local group has sort of taken something over and really put a lot of love into it. And is there an opportunity for more of that stuff to happen, do you think?
I'd love to have more opportunities like the Eagle River Nature Center. It has been a great success, and we would love to find partners mm-hmm, like that in other areas.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about the Huts Association and all the mm-hmm, time they put into that that hut, and then they'll have sort of a fall barn raising to bring in wood, and then they have a party, and sort of that's something that makes it fun. I mean, Jim, have you thought about some of that, about how you could get more people out there?
Well, yeah, I got a couple thoughts. You know, one is that, you know, listeners out there, you know, don't think of yourself as volunteering singly. You know, get a group of people together, you know, if you're a scout troop or, you know, a bunch of friends, and, you know, and then call Tom Harrison up and say, you know, it's not just me that wants to work on a trail. You know, I've got 10 people that will, you know, spend a Saturdays, and that then begins to be a you know, a enough of a workforce that, you know, I mean, Tom's got a lot on his plate. There's a lot going on, but, you know, somebody comes up with, you know, 10 people to work on a trail for a Saturday. Well, they'll figure that out, where one person calling in, it's like, yeah, we'll get back to you when we get, you know, kind of a critical mass together. So that's one thing to think about. If you're out there listening, there is a group, in the state called Alaska Trails. And they're a nonprofit organization that supports, you know, trail construction and trail maintenance, you know, statewide. And I
never
think
heard
that,
of it.
And well, I rented a room to them when I was at working for NPCA. So I you know where those guys are at. And they do a lot of work, you know, with, you know, communities around the state in, you know, maintaining and developing trails. And
we'll get their website up on our website, alaskapublic.org. Yeah. Great. So, we also talked a little bit about fundraising. So in Anchorage, we have a pretty successful Anchorage Parks Foundation that was started by Mayor Begich and seems to have gone on and continued and had raised money. And you see projects around town, and they also, you know, they're not an advocacy group, but they do kind of have their voice out there all the time, so that it's a support for parks and creates sort of a more of a positive feeling for it. But we don't really have a statewide organization like that here, do we?
No.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, we had one. Neil Johansson, who was had the job before me, started the Alaska State Park Foundation. And the problem there is that it was not started by the grassroots. It was started by the park director. And that's not a sustainable model for a nonprofit organization. You have to have a lot of passion at the grassroots in order to, you know, sustain something like that going forward. And that was, you know, what happened. The thing pretty much died under my tenure because I couldn't put the time into nurturing an organization, because the people that were involved were all very well-meaning, but they all had other things going on. It was not the number one important thing in their life. And it kind of fizzled out.
Right.
Because it didn't come from the grassroots up. It was, you know, kind of an administrative
idea. It's kind of time for people to
step
up.
It's time for a grassroots effort.
Yeah.
And as I said, we're very parochial. So you've got friends of Hatcher Pass. You have friends of Ketchmack Bay. You have friends groups that are great throughout the state. Mm-hmm. But they focus solely on that particular area that they're very passionate about. The type of thing that we're talking about on a statewide foundation, you have to have a broader a philosophy on what you're trying to do as far as state park system is concerned, rather than the individual areas. But we still have some great fundraisers from our friends groups that help us in specific parks.
How does that work? So they raise money for a particular project, or what's happening?
Right. They will raise money for Ketchmack Bay, the Friends of Ketchmack Bay, very active. They will, in the springtime, let's say in May, they'll have a pancake feed during the Shorebird Festival. Mm-hmm. They have merchandise that they will sell. They have a number of fundraising sort of events during the year. Then they'll take that money and apply it toward work on a trail or work on some project within Ketchmack Bay State Park.
So there's also groups like, I think it was called Project Raleigh, which would bring kids from overseas mm-hmm. to build trails. I'm getting some nods. It seems like it's a great youth summer activity to work on trails and something that kids would probably really enjoy. Is there a limitation in your budget, Ben, as you continue to get cut and cut and cut, even to coordinate some of these outside helpers?
It's not so much the budget part, but it's just a manpower and resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the amount of oversight that a group, say that, in a great group would take. We don't have, like, let's say, three trail crew people to be able to be in three different places. So our limitation is more on the amount of time that our current staff has rather than and that definitely relates to budgets in the sense of not having enough money to hire somebody else. But our capacity is what limits us more than anything else.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about our state parks and funding them and the challenges we're facing as state revenues decline. It's a tough topic, you know, as we're talking about laying off state troopers and laying off teachers, and yet we love our parks, and it's why a lot of us live here. So it matters too. So that's a topic today, and maybe inspiring some listeners to think about what we can do as a community to support these parks. With me are Jim Stratton, a former director of state parks, and Ben Ellis, the current director. I wanted to talk about what some of the top needs are, and I obviously spend a lot of time on Kachemak Bay, so I'm very aware of the issues there. And one of the things that I see there is that there's the Saddle Trail, which is a beautiful trail, heavily used by tourists, heavily used by water taxis, got tons of maintenance work this summer and is in fantastic shape. Some of the other trails, which are maybe more for sort of the locals, the Alaskans, that are more challenging, are really overgrowing. And then there's a couple that I think have been abandoned, like the Mallard Bay Trail. There's a platform there that's sort of gone. And so one of my things, I think, if I were going to be saying what are priorities, and I want to hear priorities from each of you about what you would do. You mentioned, Ben, the snow machine thing, that we're not really dealing with that user group as well as we should. One of my things would be like, just some pioneer work, some minimal work to get some of these trails, you know, usable condition, even if they're not the busiest trails, but so that those of us who do a lot of hiking, you know, we're not losing mileage of trails. So that's something that I would think of. And now I'd like to hear, as we go around the table, you know, what are some priorities? Like, what could we be doing that you'd like to see, where you feel like, wow, we need to be doing more in a particular area? Jim, do you want to take that?
I pretty much recreate in, you know, in Chugach State Park. Uh-huh. And, you know, the trails that I, you know, recreate there, I was out, you know, up at, you know, Glen Alps, and there's a bunch of trail work being done up there this summer.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I have it off the top of my head going, uh-huh, oh, we need to be at this trail or this trail. You know, I think that, you know.
But I mean, if suddenly, if the magic fairy came and said, Jim, we've now got extra resources for state parks, where would you use them?
I'd actually ask Ben. You know, you know, I haven't been a park director. I haven't, uh-huh, been the park director for like, you know, almost 14 years. And so, you know, Ben, yeah, Ben's the one that knows, you know, which trails are being used and which ones are, you know.
You're a park user, though.
Yeah. And I would turn around, uh-huh, and talk to my superintendents, uh-huh, because as Jim well knows, you sit in the seat, you wish you knew as much and everything throughout the park that your superintendents and your rangers do. But they're the ones that are out day in and day out. They have the contact with, especially the rangers, with the public. They see these trails. So we would, and we do this already. If we had more money, we could do more of it. But that we prioritize the work. There's, I've already said, more work that's needed to happen than what we've gotten the money for. So the superintendents will go through and prioritize, whether it's trails or whatever the issues are. And the limited amount of funding that we do receive goes to those areas. If we can match it with federal money, that is a big plus. Right. So we take 20% of state money and get 80% from the federal money to be able to improve a trail, then we'll definitely do that. Or we'll work with the Pittman-Roberts money from Fish and Game, Dingle Johnson money, whatever. I mean, we're looking for partners in every way we can find them.
Uh-huh. You've got these different funding streams, and you're figuring out how to use them.
Yeah, that's one thing that I would say about, you know, people who run parks, particularly state parks. They are so, so good at finding a penny and keeping stuff going with baling wire and duct tape. When I was director and talking to the superintendents and the park rangers, and you talk about budget cuts, I mean, the idea of reduced, you know, services, they didn't even want to talk about that. So how can we keep doing more with less, more with less, more with less? And that's just the attitude of the people that work at state parks. They love what they do. They're dedicated to the park system, and they're dedicated to keeping them open for the public. And so they're the ones that really are on the ground. And if, you know, and if somebody came down and gave them $500,000, they would know exactly where to invest it, because they're the ones that are out there every day.
Yeah. Of course, that's not going to happen. It's more likely that we're going to have more budget cuts. Right. We're hearing about that struggle getting started for the 2016 legislative session, and certainly will be, you know, a significant budget cuts again this year. Is that something you're sort of thinking about, Ben, and how you're going to handle that?
Well, we're looking at our system, and we do anticipate a reduction. We don't see new money coming in.
Yeah.
And so the scenarios that we're working on are how deep that these might be. We're working with the administration, obviously, toward the various goals that the administration has. And then once the budget's released in December, December 15th, starting in January, we'll start working with the legislature on answering questions, following up with requests, and see where their funding level comfort is, just like we did this last year.
So would you presumably be looking at around at more areas that might be mothballed or that kind of solution?
Could be. We don't know yet. In my crystal ball, I'm not sure where we're going. I think the only thing that's certain is we're not going to have any more money.
Right, right. I wanted to ask about the public use cabins before we finish because, they're such a bargain, right? And they're beautiful. They're really nicely built. Are those self-sustaining?
Some are and some are. We don't look at them individually, but let me tell you, public use cabins got a great story, and that is that more and more of them lately, and you've probably noticed, are being built on the road system, or they're being mm-hmm. built in campgrounds, or they're being built in areas that are more accessible for the general public. We thought that would drop the need, the demand. What it actually has done is grown the pie,
right?
Because we have more handicap folks using them than ever before. Mm-hmm. And we have very, very young families that have never camped. They may be from the lower 48.
Introducing them to the whole
introducing
thing.
Introducing them into it. So we've actually grown the pie and we have more demand. But we try to balance still providing some cabins in a remote area so folks can ski out or hike out and camp. But more and more of them go to the local areas and road accessibility, and we see it's a large revenue generator definitely within our system.
Okay, great, and awful fun too. And I've always enjoyed how you have a 7-month reservation system for Alaskans, six months for everybody
else.
That's
right.
We
put that in place when I was there because, people were getting pretty angry about, what do you mean I can't get my favorite cabin because somebody from Iowa's got it?
Yeah, that's great. Well, I want to thank both of my guests, and I know that you are fighting the good fight, so I'm sorry for giving you a hard time.
Not a problem. It's been enjoyable.
Hopefully we've inspired a few people to get involved and support some of these friends organizations, which are mm-hmm. scattered around the state. If you want to find out more about that kind of thing, please get on our website at alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show, and you will find links to what we've been talking about. So thanks to Ben Ellis, Director of Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. Thanks for
Thank
being with
you.
Us.
Appreciate it.
And Jim Stratton, a former director and also host of the Arctic Cactus Hour on our sister station, KMBA. Thanks
Great.
For being with us.
Yeah, thanks, Charles.
All right, well, that's it for today. Next week, we're going to be talking about a state park, Nancy Lake. I went up and had a late season canoe trip there. We're going to talk about canoeing and skating at Nancy Lake, one of my favorite places. I'd like to thank our producer, Monica Gokey, who's been producing today's show. Production assistant Grace Bojean helps us with getting the guests in the studio. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.